Welcome to the Aquarimax Audio Show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 97, recorded January 23rd, 2012.
Okay, who have we got this week?
We have Anne in Pittsburgh and Mick in Carnforth in the UK.
Cool. So what does Anne have to say to start with?
Anne has a conundrum.
A conundrum?
An absolute conundrum.
Which species of conundrum?
Well, let's find out. She says in her email, I've had some mysterious die-offs of neons and killifish lately. No noticeable disease or change in behavior until the day before they get lethargic and die. But my German blue rams, dwarf neon blue ricefish, endlers, and emerald dwarf rasboras so far seem to be doing well. I just noticed one or two white spots, ick, on a couple of the ricefish, and one on one of the rams. I lost our male bristlenose at the same time. I am slowly turning up the temperature, about 2 degrees a day, to 80 to 82 degrees, and was going to add half a dose of salt and or Cordon Organic Ick Attack, safe for the shrimp I have in the tank as well, after removing the filter carbon. Now, just a couple of days ago, the German blue ram spawned for the first time. They spawned on a couple large, flat leaves of a rooted plant, ID unknown, in a kind of cave under some thick floating plants. I'm enjoying watching the male and female trading off guarding the eggs and tending them. The German blue ram's colors, as well as the spawning behavior, was why I set up a planted tank in the first place, so I'm excited to finally have a pair and see this. I am not sure what ick treatment would be safe now. Hence the conundrum, yes? I wanted to catch the rice fish and do a dip instead, but was unsuccessful at catching them without tearing the tank apart, which would disturb the eggs. They are fast, and there's lots of wood and plants and caves to hide behind. Do you think either of these treatments would be safe for the eggs, or if they hatch the fry, or how about frequent vacuuming of the substrate to keep the ick down? I've started feeding anti-parasite food, too, in the meantime, just to cover all bases, though I know that's really for internal parasites.
Okay, well, Anne, that is a conundrum indeed, and there are a couple in there.
A canoodling conundrum.
Well, I don't know about that. But congratulations on the German blue ram fry. I mean, that's cool. I love cichlid fry of any kind, but... Oh, well, yeah, that's true. Hopefully fry by now.
Hopefully fry by now, yes.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, and I did, I sent Anne an email and asked whether the neons and killifish were in the same tank as the other fish, and she said yes, because I wasn't sure from the email and wanted to check about that. And I thought continuing with the elevated temperature was a good idea. That's usually the only thing I use to treat ick in a planted tank, especially if it's got sensitive inverts like shrimp in it.
You don't put medicine in it.
Nope, I just elevate the temperature. So it's probably the safest with the rams, even the ram fry. Rams are generally good with high temperatures. You keep rams with discus, which are like really warm water fish. You can keep discus at, you know, 86 and things like that, and that's pretty comfortable for them.
So where are these German blue rams from?
Well, they're not from Germany.
They're
at least not originally.
Next you're going to be telling me that French fries are not from France.
Well, German blue rams are actually from South America. But by way of Germany, in that the wild ones, the original ancestors, mm-hmm. came from South America. But the color variety, I believe, was either developed or popularized by German aquarists. So that's how that works. But at any rate, I'm not sure how the other species in the tank would do, and fry are often a little more sensitive than adults, so that could be an issue temperature-wise.
Maybe.
But going to 82 I don't think is a problem at all. But going a little higher may or might not be a problem. I mean, it's a little touch and go there, a bit tricky. The last outbreak of ick that I had, which was totally my fault because I didn't quarantine some new purchases, was a couple of years ago in a tank with some young angelfish, some emperor tetras, some bristlenose placos, a dozen or so guppies, and some red cherry shrimp. It was a planted tank, too. So I gradually raised the temperature, got to about 88. Pretty hot.
That's pretty warm.
You know, the temperature really affects the amount of dissolved oxygen that can be effectively held in water. And so there's not a whole lot at 88. It really starts to plummet around 85 or 86.
So they all up at the top of the tank?
They weren't, actually. I just monitored them carefully, and they did okay. And I took care of the ick and didn't lose any fish, didn't lose any shrimp, didn't lose any plants. Everybody was okay.
What we want.
And I actually haven't used Cordon Organic Ikatag, so I can't really comment there. I do like Cordon products, and I use several of them, but other than that, I can't really comment there. I haven't had any experience with it, so hopefully that's going to be helpful. But I would say, in general, you're on the right track. The frequent vacs of the gravel will certainly be useful in terms of reducing the parasite, those wee beasties in their inactive state down in the gravel. That does, that's a good thing. I don't know that it would do much in terms of the numbers, because you only need one or two little things to fall down there to produce thousands of them, but or at least a large number of them.
Well, while we're talking about that, take us kind of through the life cycle of ick.
Okay.
The basic idea of how that works.
I can do that. I'm not going to use all the technical terms, because I get confused between tomites and trophonts and all that stuff. They all have different names for the different stages of the life cycle.
I think what those are actually like different hairstyles at raves.
Oh, okay. Well, then
you don't have to use the technical terms.
Okay, I won't then. Basically, you get this little wee beastie swimming around in the water, and what it's looking for is a fish. When it finds a fish and attaches itself to the fish, it burrows into the layers of skin of the fish, I guess you say. Just the outer layers there. And the fish...
Underneath the scales?
Well, no, actually.
Or
no.
Above?
More like the epithelium, just the outer layer. The mucus, under the mucus,
okay.
And into the outer layers of skin there, kind of thing. And it irritates the flesh of the fish there. And
it's eating it?
It's deriving nutrients somehow from it, yeah. I don't know if it's actually taking bites or it's just stealing stuff by diffusion or what it's doing.
Okay.
But it irritates the fish, and the fish produces a cyst around it, which it's doing in an attempt to, you know, rid itself of this thing, and which is why we see the parasite, because we're not actually seeing the parasite itself. It's too small for us to see. We're seeing this irritated tissue that the fish is secreting around it, and that's the white spot.
Those are the white spots.
Right.
Okay.
But these white spots contain the little parasite, and when the parasite reaches a certain point in development, it leaves the fish, and when it does that, it sinks down to the bottom, where it begins to divide to produce more little critters. And
more evil little nasties.
Right, and so just one of those drops down and divides into a large number of the other ones. I'm not sure how many, but a lot. And then once it does that, they hatch out and look for more fish. And really, the only time you can do a whole lot with them to damage them is when they're in that little free swimming stage, which is a fairly short part of their life cycle.
So not when they're on the fish and not when they're on the bottom of the tank.
Right. When they're on the fish's tissue itself is protecting them. And when they're on the bottom of the tank, they're kind of in a protected state. It's when they're swimming around when they're vulnerable to medications. And if you can kill them when they're in that state, that's great. But also, if you can accelerate their metabolism by increasing the temperature, it takes them, they have a limited time before they can find a fish.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a ticking, you know, their time ticks away before they find a fish, they're dead. And the end of that, which is part of the reason the temperature helps. But also, once you go past the temperature
helps because it speeds up their metabolism so much that time window to find a fish is so short that they're most likely to just die.
So a lot of them will die, but
okay.
You go high enough and they just can't reproduce effectively anymore.
They just can't be alive.
When you get into the high 80s, it just doesn't work for them. So that can be dangerous for your fish because the dissolved oxygen goes low too, so you have to be really careful with using methods like that, but it's pretty effective for the ick. Like, did I mention that about when I did that? That I've done it when I had the aquarium where I had an ick outbreak and it was at about 88 degrees is what I went to, and I didn't lose any fish, I didn't lose any shrimp, and I did lose the ick, so it works.
That's what we want.
Yep. So, hopefully that'll help, and the vacuuming of the gravel can help, because it does reduce the parasites somewhat, but it doesn't, it won't get them all, but the water changes are good for the fish. Anyway, so, there you go. And it looks like Anne, when she replied, said that the eggs seem to have hatched.
Hooray!
But she didn't see any fry, so she's not sure if they had been eaten or if they're just too small to see among all the plants. And she's putting fry food in the area just to wait and see, which is good policy because it is not uncommon for cichlids to mess up their first batch of eggs, you know.
Or their second.
Or their second, or third even, and then everything's fine on the fourth. You know, things like that happen a lot. I've had that happen on occasion. But sometimes you also have the case where everything seems to be hopeless, and you lost all hope, but a couple of days have gone by, the eggs have disappeared, and then suddenly the wrigglers rise out of the gravel where they've been hiding, and you see them, and everything's cool. So, could go either way. I'll be interested to see what happens. And she says she doesn't see any white spots on any fish at the moment, but she'll keep it up, the treatments, to make sure the inactive stage of ick is gone too, which is very important.
Very good.
Because it'll get you every time if you don't. So, there you go.
How long before you should assume that it's gone?
Oh, it depends on the temperature and the medicine you're using and so on. The temperature, of course, affects that very much. Speeds up the cycle and so on, but...
How long is their cycle at not an enhanced temperature, just a normal, you know, 78 or whatever?
Well, I couldn't tell you the exact time, but I would say typically ick treatments go on for approximately a couple of weeks, depending on what you're using and so on.
Okay.
But, you know, it depends a lot on the temperature. All right. Well, hopefully that helps a little bit, and... I would say, too, just check your water parameters, because the fact that you had neons and killifish dying off and one bristlenose without any ick symptoms, and then you had a couple of fish break out in ick, makes me think there could be something going on here with the water parameters. So I would say just test them all just to be sure that there's not something
hidden
going on.
That the ick didn't come around because they were immunosuppressed from something else going on.
Exactly, because it's kind of suspect when you have a situation like that. Not that that's necessarily what's going on, but it could be, so it's worth a check. All right, well.
Shall we move on?
Yeah, well, let's go on to Mick's fish room.
Yes, now, we had hoped to have Mick do an interview over the phone with us about his fish room, but his computer's been having issues, and so we haven't really been able to touch bases with him about doing an interview on this specific topic, but we are planning in the future on interviewing him on some other topics.
Yeah, he's got all kinds of good stuff, so yeah. We'll do that, and he was kind enough to send this to us from a friend's computer.
Which is very appreciated.
So that we would have it. Yeah, this is a response to Roger's question about fish rooms. When we said we had had fish rooms, but we'd never built a separate fish room.
Built the actual structure.
So what kind of things do you need to do to worry about that? And this is Mick's response. So thank you, Mick, for putting this out, and we will go through it. He's put it together in a nice, organized 10 steps. Or not 10 steps, 10 points.
10 important things.
Yeah, 10 things to ponder. When you're
so it's a top 10 list for Andreika. Hi, Andreika.
kind of is.
Okay, so number one is location, location, location. It must be easy to get to. He says his is at the bottom of the garden, and on wet days and dark nights can be a nuisance to get to.
Yep, and one thing about maintenance tasks, whether piscine or otherwise, the easier they are, the less they are to go by the wayside when things get really tough. If you're having an extremely busy weekend... Or you're sick, and something takes 2 minutes to do, you know, and it's really close, you're more likely to do it than if it takes 15.
If you have to put on galoshes and a rain jacket to get there to do it.
Exactly, so that's a great point to bring up.
Okay, number two is power. Get an electrician to advise or install circuit breakers on sockets.
Wow, I agree with that. I don't know as much as I should know about this kind of stuff, probably, but I know enough to know that water and electricity need an expert to help keep it safe. You need to make sure you're up to code legally, but you also just need to make sure you're not going to fry yourself.
Yes, because really what's the point of creating this beautiful fish room if it all burns down or you electrocute yourself?
Yeah, either way you're not going to have a whole lot of fun in your fish room afterwards.
No, not really.
So yeah, that's a great point and well taken.
Number three, water in and out. He says he collects rainwater from the guttering and then has a conditioning drum inside the shed. He has more on that in point 10 as well. He says also when doing water changes, a sink or drain to dispose of wastewater is vital.
And you know what else is vital? That we take a break right now.
Okay.
This
isn't a commercial, because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful now, was it?
Wow. So we were just talking about Mick's way of collecting rainwater and also having a sink or a drain to be able to dispose of wastewater. I would love to be able to collect rainwater. It's too bad we live in a desert, huh?
Yeah, it doesn't rain very much.
No, but there's a lot of advantages to collecting rainwater, but we'll talk more about that as we go on. It can be really useful. Okay, so...
Number 4 is insulation. It says, I used a paint on water seal rather than Visqueen sheeting on the walls and ceiling. I then used two inch thick cellulose boarding for the insulation, and then covered that with hardboard sheeting. Okay, I have a question right now to display my lovely ignorance. Visqueen?
We usually call it Visqueen here in the U.S. Visqueen. I don't know how to pronounce it in the U.K. It is a plastic, like the stuff we've used Visqueen or something similar to Visqueen to insulate our windows in the winter. That's what that is.
The stuff that you, like, spray, not spray, but you aim a hairdryer at it and it shrinks up?
No, the other stuff. Semi-transparent thicker stuff.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
That's what that is. So, yeah, you really have to be careful about insulation in the fish room because you don't want to lose, you know, heat in the winter. And gotta be.
I imagine you don't want anything that's producing toxic fumes either.
Right. And so that's you also need to be careful because of moisture buildup that can occur. So you need a moisture barrier, so Visqueen can be a good way to do it.
Okay.
But water seal is another alternative, like the one that Mick explains here. All right. Okay.
Number 5 is heating. He says, I suggest a space heater rather than standard tank heaters. This is more economical. I have a fan heater, so the heater also circulates the air, eliminating cold spots and keeping humidity down. My heater went off over Christmas for a couple of days, and I lost lots of my stock, so I am now running 2 heaters, so if one goes out, the other one keeps up.
And I think that's a great point, that you should have some redundancy built into your heating with the 2 heaters, and also that it's more effective to space heat a fish room than it is to try to heat it with a whole bunch of heaters in your tanks. Can you imagine just setting all of those heaters?
That would be quite a task.
That would be crazy. And plugging them in? I mean, if you have 2 heaters and you have to plug them in, that's not so bad. But if you have to plug in 25 heaters, that's a pain.
You need your electrician.
And like Mick says, it's also more economical to just use 2. And I like the idea of making sure it's a fan heater, because if you have a room that's heated by a space heater and heat rises and you don't have a lot of circulation going on in the room, your tanks up in your higher tiers of your stands and so on could be several degrees warmer than the ones below.
Okay.
So, that's...
Good point.
Yeah. All right, what do we got next?
Number 6 is shelving. Look around and see what is affordable and practical for you. I built all my own shelving from timber, which I waterproof sealed. This was the best for my budget at the time I made it, but it has warped slightly. Still solid and usable, but perhaps some galvanized metal or alloy would be the ideal.
Mm-hmm. It's also important to realize that you can only build your own shelving if you're able to do that and you know how to build shelving that's going to stand up to several hundred pounds.
Tanks are heavy.
Yeah, you can make it level and you can make it very stable. So Mick is obviously capable of doing that. He did it. But if you're not sure about that, you better... look into it. And if maybe you're handy but you haven't built a stand before, there are plans on the internet. You can look that up. Do it yourself, aquarium stands, and learn more about it before you do it. But yeah, that is a good point. I know that I've used some powder coated adjustable metal shelving that you just assemble yourself. It comes in a box and you assemble it. You remember that?
Box hardware store, yeah. What was it? It's either Home Depot or Lowe's at the time. I don't remember.
Mm-hmm. And these were rated for about 250 pounds per shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And So, you know, it worked for the small tanks.
You know, for a fish shelf, it was fairly attractive.
Yeah, for a multi-tiered one. I mean, you can get some really nice cabinet-style stands and so on. That's not what it was, but for a multi-tiered shelf, it was fairly attractive. I never put anything larger than 20 gallons on it, but several.
But it was rated for 250 pounds.
Yeah, so it's not too bad. And it was strong. I don't remember the brand, but one nice thing is that you could, when you put it together, you could choose the height somewhat of each tier.
All right, number 7 is filtration. He says, I use a single pond air pump which runs around 25 outlets to box filters and air stones. This pumps directly into 13mm plastic plumbing pipe, which forms a loop back to the pump and is ideal for tapping into with a simple drill bit and a plugged-in controller valve. The more tanks you have, the bigger the pump you will need. I have a 30 liter per hour pond pump, which sits on the top shelf so there can be no back siphoning.
That's a good way to do it. If you're going to use, you're going to pump air into the tanks, that's really the way to do it. Because back siphoning is a nightmare. I've encountered back siphoning. Yeah, it's like the aquarium equivalent of back. When, for example, your power goes out, if you have your air pump lower than your tank, sometimes what will happen is you'll get the water that will suck out and then down into your pump. And, of course, a bunch of water going into your air pump is beautiful and destroys everything. You don't have an air pump after that.
Right.
And it can also, sometimes, depending on how everything's set up, can cause electrical problems and things like that. So you really don't want that, so that's a good way to do it. Keep it up above everything. And it's nice because if you have it, so it's going into this plumbing pipe, and you need another air line, all you have to do is drill into it and stick the controller valve, and then you lead another air line out.
That's very nice.
You don't have this tangled mass of T-valves everywhere either, because you've got that central plumbing pipe that you're using. So I like that. That's a good idea.
Alrighty, number 8, lighting. He says, I have used all manner of lighting. I am currently using around 9 energy saver bulbs to light around 20 tanks. I am not growing plants other than Nitella, Java moss, and Java fern, so as long as I can see the fish, okay, it works. I also have a separate light for working in there when the tank lighting is not on. I have all the tank lighting on a timer system, so they get the same lighting pattern if I'm in there or not. I found that the lighting can cost more to run than the heating.
Yeah. That's kind of scary, really, to think about that, but it makes sense. Sounds like, though, that he's found the ideal amount of lighting in terms of just enough to see, just enough to grow the plants that he needs to grow.
Are those actually, like, in lids on the tanks?
I think he has them up on the shelves, if I remember, because he talked about it in the... Well, he has a light that he can turn on in the room, but these are above the tanks, but I think they're not in hoods. I think they're mounted to
the
lower part of the shelves, yeah,
okay.
Above the tanks.
Number 9 is tank sizes. It says, like building a stone wall, big tanks on the bottom and small tanks at the top. You don't want to have 100 gallons of water suddenly collapse and flood the place. I have an assortment of tanks from 10 liters to 160 liters, but I have a friend who has 80 tanks, all exactly the same size, and he finds it ideal.
So I guess it kind of depends on what you want. Yeah, that's a lot of tanks. But I would. It makes sense to me that if you're going to have different size tanks, you'd have the smaller ones on top. Makes sense.
Number 10 is water conditioning. He says, I take the water from the collecting butt outside and fill a 100-liter drum in the shed. This is fed with an air line which runs constantly, and I then add around a fifth of a teaspoon of cichlid salt to add the buffers and increase the TDS to around 60 parts per million. When I top up the drum, I test with my TDS meter. Remind me what TDS stands for.
Total dissolved solids.
All right, okay. Test with my TDS meter, add the salts, leave it for 24 hours, and test again. This water is up to temperature and fits all the tanks ideally, and if I need to, I can use it to do 80 to 90% water changes. As a rule, I do around 25% per week on each tank.
But it is really nice to have the option to do 80 to 90% water changes.
In case you have an emergency.
Yeah, and you don't have to worry about gas bubble disease, because this water
is already,
it's already at the same pressure. Yeah, it's already outgassed. It's nice.
That's awesome.
So, I'd love to be able to do that. Part of the reason is because when you've got rainwater, you're starting with rainwater, and you go to 60 parts per million, I mean, you can breed a lot of fish that prefer you know, this water without a whole lot of total dissolved solids in it. But then if you want to breed something like rift flake cichlids, you just add more cichlid salt. Mm-hmm. And then you're good to go. So it's kind of
nice. Everybody's happy.
It's like getting your own free RO unit that falls onto your roof. So I like that. I wish we could do that.
Nice.
Yeah, he's going to be sending pictures of this when he has a chance to do so. Thank you very much for that, Mick. I'm sure Roger's glad to hear it, and I'm sure many others are happy to hear it as we are. So, I believe that is just about it for this week. Once again, thanks to both Anne and Mick for your contributions, and we hope you all have a lovely fishy week.
May the fish be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.